Okay, with the beginning of Parshas Beshalach, so the Jewish people are on the move, and the pasuk tells us about one of the aspects of them leaving Mitzrayim in Perek Yud Gimel, pasuk Yud Tes, the third pasuk of the Parsha. Vayikach Moshe es atzmos Yosef im. Moshe took Yosef's bones with him. Ki hashbeya hishbiya es b'nei Yisrael emor, for Yosef had made b'nei Yisrael take an oath. He said, "Pakod yivkod elokim eschem, Hashem will surely remember you." V'ha'aliz, and when he does, v'ha'aliz emes atz musay mize itchem, you should take me with you. And we've noted in the past, it's very interesting that this pasuk is in the beginning of Parshas Beshalach. I mean, the Jewish people have already left Mitzrayim in Parshas Bo. They've gone from Ramses to Sukkos, and then they keep on going. Moshe can't have Yosef's bones in the beginning of Beshalach if he didn't take them already at the end of Parshas Bo. Mefarshim discussed that, what exactly that, how it finds its place in the beginning of our Parsha. In any event, there's a well-known statement of the Medrash. It features also in the Gemara in the end of the first parak of Maseches Sota. In praise of Moshe, or in appreciation of Moshe, and Moshe takes, so this is the evening before they left Mitzrayim, says the Medrash, everyone else is involved in collecting gold and silver. Moshe is involved in collecting Yosef's remains. In fulfillment, says the Medrash, Alav Ne'emar, about Moshe it is said, and it quotes the pasuk from Mishle, Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvos, wise of heart will take mitzvos. And therefore we see in Moshe's depiction, an embodiment of the concept of Chacham Lev, the wise of heart, he takes mitzvos. The simple understanding of the Medrash seems to be that no one else was really involved in mitzvahs. They were going after gold and silver. Moshe was the only one involved in a mitzvah because that's what Chachmei Lev do. They do mitzvahs. And there are a number of classic questions that are raised with regards to this Medrash. Firstly, is it only Chachmei Lev who fulfill mitzvahs? I mean, all good Jews keep mitzvahs. Chacham Lev seems to be a very specific designation. It seems to be a very small subset of the entire mitzvah-keeping community. Why then would the pasuk tell us that it seems only someone who is wise of heart does mitzvahs? Secondly, for what it's worth, it happens to be that on this particular occasion, collecting gold and silver was a mitzvah. It wasn't the choice of the Jewish people. They'd been told, Daber na ba'aznei ha'am, vishalu ish me'esrei ehu, etc. So this is the one time that you can't fault anyone for collecting gold and silver, because it was a direct mitzvah to do so. We like to keep in practice, just in case it ever becomes a mitzvah again, but on this one occasion, it was a mitzvah. So you look at the Jewish people and say, well, they were going after those other things. Moshe went after mitzvahs. They're all mitzvahs. So what then does the Medrash mean to communicate to us? And there are many, many explanations and interpretations of the Medrash, and a fascinating approach to this Medrash is found in the writings of one of the great Hasidic rebbes, Reb Meir Yechiel of Ostrovtsa, in his sefer Meir Einei Chachamim. And he begins, in a sense, in the beginning, with a most basic question. The money, the gold and silver that B'nai Yisrael are collecting, what is it? What is the fulfillment here? Well, on a simple level, this is in fulfillment of the part of the promise made to Avram, Vegam Esagoy Asher Yavodu Dan Anochi, Vachrichein Yitzu B'Ruchush Gadol. So this is the Ruchush Gadol. It's the final part of the Bris Ben HaBesorim. That's the simple response. However, it's not so straightforward. The reason being that we confront again the basic question with regards to the amount of time that we actually spent in Mitzrayim. the time was originally forecast from as Ta'avadam v'ino osam arba me'oshana, 400 years. In the event, as we know, we weren't there for 400 years. Nowhere near, just over half, in fact. We were there for the 210 years. Now, aside from the many implications of this question, there will also be ramifications for the fulfillment of Achrei Chen Yitzu B'Rechush Gadol, because the Pasuk states that this will happen afterwards, after Arba Me'oshana. Now, if we're there for 400 years, so then we can leave after the 400 years, B'Rechush Gadol. But what if we weren't? And therefore, opinions, as we know, are divided as to how to resolve this issue. How to see that we were there for 210 years, what about the 400 years? There are a number of ways to understand that the 400 years were served in one form or another, either because the clock begins ticking with the birth of Yitzchak, and indeed from the birth of Yitzchak until we left Mitzrayim was 400 years, or perhaps the harshness of the servitude and the bitterness compressed 400 years worth into 210 years. According to these approaches, indeed, we could see ourselves as being in the Acharei Chen zone at this stage. The 400 years have been served, and if that's the case, then this money would be very simply the Rechush Gadol, Acharei Chen, it's a Rechush Gadol. But there is another approach, and it's based on the Medrash, that the answer to the question is, if the question is, we're meant to be there for 400 years, where are the other 190 years? The answer is, they're not there. And we didn't stay there for 400 years. Because we weren't able to stay there, the situation was too dire. You have the famous statement of the Arizal, that you have the 49 levels of Tumah, and we were basically as unfortunately, behaviorally, as low as one could go, if one ever expects to come back. And therefore, Golus Mitzrayim had to be suspended, which has major implications, not least of which is that it seems that in subsequent Golios, at least part of them, was finishing the original 400 years, which couldn't be served all at one time. Now, according to this approach, let us ask the question, so why are they leaving Rechush Gadol? If we're not Acharei Chen, there shouldn't be a Rechush Gadol. What then is the nature of this gold and silver that we're collecting? Well, the answer says Rav Meir Yechiel is very simple. The Rechush Gadol of the promise made to Avram is not the only way to understand why we would be deserving of gold and silver. There is also the fact that we've been working for Mitzrayim for decades. However long the Shibud was, perhaps 116 years, perhaps 86 years, that's a long time, and the Jewish people as a nation are at work for no pay, and therefore it's very simply back wages. Leave aside the issue of Rechush Gadol. That could be. And indeed, historically, there was a famous episode which is recorded by the Gemara in the beginning of Perek Chelek and the end of Sanhedrin, in the time of Alexander the Great, when there was a great reckoning and there was a delegation sent from Egypt, and they came to sue the Jewish people. They wanted their money back. They'd read the Torah, parts of it anyway, specifically the part which says that we borrowed from them gold and silver. Apparently we didn't give it back. And therefore, with the Bible on their side, they came to the international court of Alexander the Great to, he should arbiter this issue. And one of the Chachamim of amongst the Jewish people, Gevir ben Pasisa was his name, he took them on. And he said, if you're already here, let's begin to make a cheshbon in terms of the amount of people that were enslaved, the time they were enslaved for no pay, and when we do, we may conclude that you actually owe us money. So if you're here, perhaps you can arrange to fill in the rest. So the Egyptian delegation asked for time to think about it, and they thought about it, and they went home. And that was the end of that case. So it's certainly possible to see the money that they took as very simply nothing more than payment earned. More recently in our times, a few years ago, there was actually a case that one of the Egyptian lawyers again wanted to sue Israel for their money back. Apparently, he had not been keeping up with the Daf Yomi, but his claim was dealt with very quickly in the above manner. In any case, we see there are two ways of looking at this money. Very interesting. The money is the same, but is it the Rechush Gadol, or is this payment for services rendered, so to speak? And should we ask the question, well, does it make a difference? I mean, money is money. Will it affect anything? The answer, says Rav Meir Yechiel, is it could make a difference with regards to a subset of the Jewish people known as Shevet Levi. Because, as we know, Shevet Levi never worked. They were not. They were somehow excused. They never got involved in the first place, and they remained outside of it. So they are not working for the Egyptians all of this time. So now the question is it acceptable for Levi, the tribe of Levi, to be involved in the collecting of gold and silver? And here, says the Ostrovtzer Rebbe, we will see that it depends. It depends what's the nature of this money. If it's a fulfillment of Achrei Chen Yetzu Berechush Gadol, they're equally deserving of leaving Berechush Gadol. They shouldn't suffer just because they had the foresight not to get involved. I mean, they are Ger Yezarecha Be'eretz Lo Lahem. They're part of the Jewish people. They should also be part of the fulfillment of Achrei Chen Yetzu Berechush Gadol. However, we should also consider, conversely, that if the money is actually not really the Rechush Gadol, but rather it's for their work, well, if they didn't work, then it's not appropriate for them to be involved in collecting money for work they didn't do, and it's not yet the Rechush Gadol. So that's an interesting shaila. We should expect to see that Shevet Levi will either be in or out, depending on the nature of what this collection is about. However, says the Ostrovtzer Rebbe as he continues, we've also seen that even if it's true that the Jewish people came out in the middle, which is the second approach, right, halfway through or just over halfway through Golas Mitzrayim, even if it's true, it is also true that no one was aware of this. This was not information that was for the ears of the Jewish people. Very simply because, as they're leaving, they don't wish to be told, essentially, that the Golus isn't over. At least give them their time. And in fact, this is what the Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos and Daf Tes, in explanation of the name that Hashem gave to Moshe at the burning bush. Moshe says, they'll ask me, what's his name? V'omri mashimo ma'omar alehem. Hashem says, Kotamar lebnei Yisrael, Eheye asher eheye. That's the name, Eyashariya. Kotamar the Bnei Yisrael, Eheyesh Lochani Aleichem. That's the Gemara that we referred to last week. So this seems to be something of a contradiction internally. Originally the name is Eheyesh Asher Eheyesh. But say to Bnei Yisrael, Eheyesh Lochani Aleichem. Why was the name abbreviated or truncated in terms of the answer to Moshe versus Moshe's message to Bnei Yisrael? And the Gemara says, and Rashi quotes it there in Parsha Shemos, because Eheye Asher Eheye, it has a meaning. It means Eheye, I will be with them through this Golos till the end. Ve'eheye imayim begolios acheres, I'll be with them in subsequent Golios. That's the full meaning of that name. Eheye, this Golos, Asher Eheye, in subsequent Golios. But Moshe said, or countered, so to speak, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the famous words, Daya Litzara Bishata. Enough! In its time, we've got enough on our plate with this Golos. We don't want to be talking about, they don't want to hear about other Golios. And Hashem accepted. And as the Maharal points out, Hashem never told Moshe to tell all of this about Israel. He's first telling Moshe, be aware, there will be other Golios. As far as the Jewish people are concerned, 100%. Don't tell them about subsequent Golios, right? Let them celebrate one Pesach without having to worry about going into Golos again. And therefore say to Bnei Yisrael, Ehye Shelochani Aleichem. Just the one, I'm with you in this Golos, and that's it. As far as the Jewish people are concerned, there's no more Golos. Now, if they left Mitzrayim in the middle, then in a sense there must be other Golias, because the term of 400 years hasn't been served. But what we see from here is that even if they did leave in the middle, they were not alerted to the fact that it's actually the middle and there will be subsequent Golias. As far as they're concerned, they finished with Golias. But what that means is that as the Jewish people were collecting the gold and silver, it seems now that they had a slightly different understanding of what they were doing than what the reality was. In reality, it's perfectly acceptable for them to accept gold and silver. Not as Rechush Gadol, because they're nowhere near there yet, but at the very least in terms of payment for their slavery. But they didn't look upon it that way. They saw themselves as having seen the Golas out, this is the end, and Achrecheinu, it's a Rechush Gadol. But what that means is, the tribe of Levi, under this understanding of what's happening here, also were involved in the collection. And it had to be that way, because Moshe was not able to alert anyone or advise anyone, for Shevet Levi, for example, that it's not appropriate for you to collect, because this isn't the Rechush Gadol, the Golas hasn't finished. Moshe can't tell that to anyone. And therefore you have all of the Jewish people, including Shevet Levi, as far as they're concerned, gathering together the Rechush Gadol. The only exception is Moshe. Moshe doesn't collect gold and silver because he's the only one who knows, and he's got to keep it to himself, that as a Levi, he can't collect. And therefore he goes after Atmos Yosef. That's his mitzvah. And that's why the Medrash adduces, in terms of Moshe's unique activities on this evening, the Pasuk in Mishle, Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvos. One who is wise in his heart will take mitzvahs. Why is Moshe on this occasion referred to as one who is wise in his heart? Because he had to keep his wisdom in his heart. He had to keep the knowledge that he knew about the nature of this collection, he had to keep it to himself. Everybody else thinks this is the Rechush Gadol, they think the Golus is finished. Moshe knows in his heart that's not true, that he can't tell anyone. But for him, he pursues the path of Atzmos Yosef. So this is the fascinating explanation of this Medrash from Rav Meir Yechiel, the Ostrovtzer Rebbe. Now, the highlight, of course, of Parshas Beshalach is Kriyas Yamsuf, and we find that this is described in Perek Yudalet, and the water parts, and the Jewish people go through, and then the Mitzrayim follow them, but they don't make it out the other side. In Pasuk Kaf Zayin, Perek Yudalet, Pasuk Kaf Zayin, we've skipped a little bit, we've cut actually past the chase, and we're in Pasuk Kaf Zayin, Vayet Moshe Es Yodo Al Hayam. Moshe stretches out his hand, the waters are currently parted, but he stretches out his hand again, Vayashav Hayam, Lifnos Boker Le'esano. And towards the morning, the sea comes back, Le'esano, to its original form, Umitzrayim Nosim Likrosim, Mitzrayim, they're running away, but they're running to it, because basically the water's closing in on all sides. Hashem shakes Mitzrayim up in the sea, and that's Vezedim Tibata, Vayichasu Mayim Tzareim, Echad Mehem Lo Nosa. Now, with regards to this phrase in Pasuk Kaf Zayin, which says that the sea returned Vayashav Hayam Lifnos Boker Le'esano. What is the meaning of the word Le'esano? Rashi comments, and he only has one comment, and it's Al Pi Pshat. And that is that the word Esan means strength, like Esan Moshavecha, Etan. So Le'esano means, says Rashi, Letokfo Harishon, to its original strength. That means that from a certain point of view, the sea has been weakened, it's been compromised. It should normally fill the whole seabed, but it's been not allowed to do that, it's been suspended, literally, and therefore when it can return, it returns to its original shape, that means to its full, it's in full force. It's in full form. And therefore, le'etano, it returns to its strength, says Rashi, le'tokvo harishon. And Unkelus translates similarly the word le'etano, le'tokpe. Tokpe is tokvo, tokef. That's the pshat. The Medrash in Bereishis Rabba and also in Shmos Rabba has a fascinating comment, which has major implications as well. And that is, the Medrash explains the word, interprets the word le'etano as almost like an anagram. Litna'o. Tna'o from the word tnai, a condition, a proviso. And that means, in the words of the Medrash, that there was a condition that was made with the Yam Suf from the very beginning. Tnai hisna HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Hayam. Hashem made a condition with the sea that it should split for the Jewish people. And at this point, it had fulfilled its condition. Mission accomplished. Or condition accomplished. The Medrash, it seems, perhaps is not entirely satisfied by explaining that le'etano means force, because a body of water isn't really an expression of force. We have understood that it will fill out the sea again, but where is the strength here? And therefore, there's room for the Medrash to explain that le'etano has an element of, an aspect of tnai. Hashem made a condition with the sea. It's interesting that the pasuk refers to this when the condition is fulfilled, not when it was invoked. As if to say, we don't find the pasuk talking about the tnai when the sea split, which is really when the condition would be invoked, but rather when the whole thing was completed, and the condition was completed, it referred to its original form, then you, looking back, you said this was a contingency situation based on that condition. The Rambam discusses this medrash at length, actually, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos in the fifth perek, and he sees in it a very important statement in terms of the nature of Hashem's will being unchanging, in the sense that even what seems to be a glitch or departure from the nature of things was already pre-programmed into the nature of things. That's a very important idea that the Rambam sees fit to emphasize based on this medrash. There is a fascinating story that relates to this medrash, and it was told over by Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap of Yerushalayim. He heard it from Rav Shmuel Salant, who heard it from Rav Yitzchak of Voloshin. Rav Yitzchak of Voloshin was the son of Rav Chaim of Voloshin, and the story is about him. His father, Rav Chaim, of course, was one of the primary disciples of the Vilna Gaon. And he didn't live nearby. From time to time, or periodically, he would go and visit the Gaon in Vilna. And on one occasion, and I think this was just a year or so before the Vilna Gaon passed away, so his son, Reb Yitzchak, Reb Itzel of Voloshin, was already, I think, 10 years old. And he'd never been to see the Vilna Gaon. He'd heard about him, of course, from his father, who spoke about him a lot. He'd never seen the Gaon, and he decided that he wanted to see the Vilna Gaon. So the next time he heard that his father was on his way to Vilna, he asked if he could come along. Can I come and see the Gaon? And he retells the story of that visit. And he relates that as soon as he asked his father, can I come to see the Gaon with you? He said, my father, he just was in shock. And he looked stunned. And he said to me, are you sure? Are you sure you want to come with me to see the Gaon? You could see the trepidation on Reb Chaim, the notion of bringing his son to see the Gaon, just to impress upon his son what it meant. Reb Yitzchak of Voloshin, well, Yitzchak at that time was 10 years old, he said, yes, I'm sure. So Reb Chaim thought about it, and in at length he said, okay, I'll take you with me. So when the wagon came, before they get up on the wagon to go to Vilna, Reb Chaim turns to his son again and says, are you sure? You can stay home if you want. Are you sure you want to come and see the Rebbe? And Yitzchak of Voloshin had never seen his father like this. That he said, yes, I'm sure. So off they went. And a couple of times throughout the trip, Reb Chaim still turns to Yitzchak and says, you sure you want to see the Rebbe? You can wait outside. And Yitzchak kept on saying, yes, I want to see him. Until finally, and he says that the closer they got to Vilna, he almost didn't recognize his father by the time they got there. He was completely white and looked absolutely terror-struck. Finally, they reach the house of the Vilna Gaon, and they're about to knock on the door and go inside. And for the last time, Reb Chaim Volozhin turns to his son and says, "This is it. Are you sure?" And Yitzhak says, "Yes, I'm sure." He doesn't has no idea what's going to happen now, but he knows that he has to see the Vilna Gaon. So they go inside. So as they enter the room, this is Reb Yitzhak now recounting this later on. When they enter the room where the Gaon was learning, so he didn't notice them because he was learning. So Yitzchak looks at his son, Reb Chaim. I mean, go and say hello. Reb Chaim is not moving. He's rooted to the spot. He can't disturb the Rebbe when he's learning. At length, the Gaon senses someone in the room. He looks up, and that's when he catches his first glimpse of Reb Chaim and his son, Yitzchak. So he greets them. He invites them over. And asked what they're here for, but very quickly the discussion moves to Divrei Torah. I mean, it's the Gaon of Vilna, and he was very perturbed, and he shared with them what was bothering him. He said, "You know that my approach is, and this is the way that I've learned through Chumash and all of Chazal, is that every statement of Chazal is ultimately referred to in the Chumash itself, and." I'm considering at the moment this well-known statement of Chazal that Hashem was made a t'nai with the Yamsuv, with the sea, that it should split. And I can see it in Parshas B'Shalach, where it says Le'itano. But Parshas B'Shalach said that Hashem made this t'nai at the time that he created the sea. But I don't see it when he created the sea. Where is the reference, where is the indication in Maaseh Bereishis that such a condition was made with the sea that it would part for Bnei Yisrael? He says, I'm thinking about it, and when the Vilna Gaon, and this Reb Chaim himself tells over, and something he witnessed on many occasions, when the Vilna Gaon was until he'd worked something out, he wouldn't eat, he wouldn't sleep, he wouldn't drink, nothing could happen, nothing moved until he'd worked it out. So he shared this problem with Reb Chaim Volozhin. So the Gaon is thinking, Reb Chaim Volozhin is thinking, and then someone tugs at Reb Chaim Volozhin's sleeve. It's Yitzhak, his son Yitzhak, his 10-year-old son. He says, "Father, I have a teretz." He'd heard the Shaila. So Reb Chaim said, "No, you don't. You can't have a teretz. I mean, this is the Vilna Gaon's question. He's bothered by it." But Yitzhak said, "No, ask the Rebbe if he'll let me say a teretz." So Reb Chaim is mortified, but his son says he has a teretz. So he said, would the Rebbe be prepared to hear a suggestion from my son? And the Gaon says, "Yes, of course." So this is 10 years old, Yitzhak of Volozhin. He says that on the day that the sea was formed, which is the second day, it says Vayomer Elokim, Yikavu Hamayim Amokam Echad, because everything was covered by water. So Hashem said that the water be collected into one place, V'seiroe Hayabasha, and then let dry land be seen. Vayihich. So you could say, said the young Yitzhak, that if water was covering the land, because it was everywhere, but then it's moved to one place, then as soon as it's moved to one place, the dry land will be seen. And therefore, when the pasuk says, Yikavu hamayim amakam echad, the water is there, is collected, so then the dry land is naturally seen. Which means that the words, V'seira'e hayabasha, could be seen as redundant. Because if they're not covered by water anymore, then they're seen, then they're revealed. Perhaps the pasuk is alluding to the fact that Yikavu Hamayim Amokam Echad, the sea will be collected, but then the pasuk goes on to state V'seira'e Hayabasha, meaning even within the sea there is a proviso that dry land will be seen. That's a reference to the condition that it should split for the Jewish people. So Yikavu Hamayim Amokam Echad already implies that all of the land will be revealed, where it's not sea anymore. But V'seira'e Hayabasha, even in the sea, when the time comes, that's the T'nai That's my suggestion, said Yitzhak of Voloshin. And the Gaon heard it, he thought about it, and he accepted it. And he gave him a bracha, that he should be a god of Yisrael, and Rabbi Yitzhak of Voloshin grew up to take over as the Rosh Yeshiva of Voloshin from his father. So that was his, one doesn't get a greater haskama than that. So that was the Dvar Torah that was discussed on that meeting between Rabbi Yitzhak, Rabbi Chaim, and the Gaon himself. I should mention, just as a PS, I haven't seen anyone else refer to this, but it's worthwhile to consider the words of Rabbeinu Bachya here on this pasuk, where it says, again, the water came back, lifnos boker le'esano, I mean, that's where what we're talking about. The Alderach HaPshat, says Rabbeinu Bachya, le'esano is milashon tokef, v'koach, it's strength, like Rashi said. The Alderach HaMedrash, le'esano, means litna'o, in fulfillment of its condition. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, five words. V'chein romaz b'breishis. And similarly, it alluded to, in Breishis, v'seira'eh hayabasha. End quote. Rabbeinu Bachya is basically saying what Rabbi Yitzhak of Voloshin said later on, that the remez to this idea is in Parshas Breishis with the words v'seira'eh hayabasha, even within the sea. So the 10-year-old Rabbi Yitzhak of Voloshin would mechaven to Rabbeinu Bachya in seeing this in Parshas Bereishis. Okay, it's important just to reflect on I think an aspect of the story whereby Rabbi Chaim of Voloshin and the Vilna Gaon, I mean, they're the Misnagdim, they're the Litvaks, and what sometimes gets thrown out a little bit is that the Litvish approach as opposed to the Hasidish approach, the Hasidim have unlimited reverence for the Rebbe, and the Litvaks are somewhat more distant. That's not true at all. You see what it means for Reb Chaim to visit it, and he'd visited him before, and he's pale, and he's trembling. Reb Yitzhak said he could see his father's knees shaking as he was about to go into the room. In terms of reverence for the Rebbe, that's unlimited. Mora rabach kumora shamayim, kipshuto. The only question is, reverence as what? In what capacity? As a teacher, as a role model, as an inspiration, as a mentor, all of those things, for that there's unlimited reverence. In terms of what the Hasidim came to see, the role that the Rebbe was taking as some form perhaps of a substitute or intermediary or however it's expressed and whatever they took exception to, that's a different story altogether. But the moral here is not diminished kavod for the Rebbe, it's just understanding what capacity that kavod takes. So, if we take a look, and I would like to, just for a moment, it's a pshat issue, it's a parshanut issue, but important because it's from Shira Sayam, we say these words regularly, and in the beginning of the Shira, in Perek Tesvav Pasuk Beis, Ozi v'zimras ka vayehi li lishua. They're words that are familiar to us all. The question is, what do these words mean? They are not easy to translate. And the reason why is because if you look at the first two words, the word Ozi has a yud at the end, and the word Zimras does not, which already means that syntactically they're disjointed, that they don't flow. There's no Oz v'Zimras or Ozi v'Zimrasi. It's Ozi v'Zimras. How exactly do they go together? And indeed, we will see, and we will just be consulting Rashi and Unkelus, the simplest of the approaches. But we will see that in order to get a straight reading, just as a translation of these words, we would have to do one of two things. You can't leave these words and read them as one with a yud and one with not. You'll either need to perceive another yud added onto to the word Zimras, as to say Zimrasi, which can happen. Or you'll need to perceive the yud at the end of Ozi as extra and read them both as if there's no yud. Those are the two paths that are available. To see them as if they both have a yud or as if neither of them have a yud. And we will see that Rashi and Unculus are divided on this question. And moreover, that will lead us further to consider what does the word Zimras mean, even as a root? What's its translation? Unculus translates, on the words Ozi v'Zimras ka, Tokvi v'tushpachti. So Tokvi is strength, like we saw le'esano, le'tokvo. Tokvi, my strength, v'tushpachti, and my praise. Vahavali lefarak, and Hashem saved me. Vayihili lishua. In other words, what Unculus has done is that he has translated the pasuk. It's a translation, as if there are two yuds. So Ozi is Tokvi, my strength. Vizimrasi is Tushpachti, my praise. As if Vizimras, as if it's Vizimrasi. And moreover, we see that he understands that the word, the root of the word Zimrasi is like Zmiras, is like praise, like Halel Zimra. Okay. Rashi has a number of issues with Unculus. We'll just mention one of them. And that is that if indeed this first word, Ozi, the Yud is the first person possessive, my strength, there's just one problem. It should not have been vowelized that way. With a comma, it's Ozi, because my strength is always Uzi. Uzi is Elecha Azamra, Hashem Uzi, Uma Uzi. And my strength, the word is Oz. But if it's my Oz, it's Uzi, not Ozi. That's a problem. Okay. So what's the solution? Says Rashi, it's for that reason I do not see this Yud as being the grammatical mine, my strength. No, rather the Yud is extra, so to speak. Now, that means that the word Ozi is really to be taken as the word Oz, the strength. Now, an extra Yud, do we find such a thing? Well, actually we do, quite commonly, especially in Shira. In Halal, we have it a number of times at the beginning. Mikimi me'afardal is really make him. It's a description of Hashem. He is Mekim Me'afardal. The Yud at the end is for Shira purposes. Mekimi. Lehoshivi. Imdivim. Etc. Moshivi Akeres Abayis is really Moshiv. And therefore, Ozi is really Oz. Thus, says Rashi, the words Ozi v'Zimras, the Yud is taken for the Melitzas Hashir, right, for the Shir aspect, but it's really, grammatically, it shouldn't be part of the translation, but rather it means the strength, and Zimras, says Rashi, does not mean praise. But rather, the word Lizamer has two meanings. It could either mean to praise like Zimras, or it could mean to cut, like in Shemitah, Karmacha lo tizmor. Right, to prune the vineyard, that's mazmerot, saccateurs, scissors. And therefore here, says Rashi, the meaning is, Ozi v'zimras ka means the strength and the cutting power, so to speak, of Hashem, batihi l'Yeshua, they are what saved me. So we see in brief, and it's just the taich, just to get a reading of those words, Rashi and Unculus take different paths in understanding what's Ozi v'Zimras Ka, and how does it lead to Vayihi li Lishua? For Unculus, these are two separate things. Hashem is my strength and my praise. Vatihi li Lishua, and he saved me. Zimras says praise. And there's two yuds perceived here, whereas for Rashi, grammatically, there's no yuds here. Oz v'Zimras Ka, Hashem's strength and cutting power. Vatihi li Lishua, they are what were my salvation. Okay. Now, having looked just for a moment at the parshanut meaning of these words, we should note that this pasuk is very interesting, because I think, actually there's one other exception, but it's largely exceptional, in that this pasuk appears elsewhere in Tanakh, word for word. In Hala, after Min HaMeitzar, Ozi v'Zimras Ka v'Tehi L'Yeshua, it's exactly the same, which is fascinating. Rarely do we find a word-for-word lifting of a pasuk from Chumash elsewhere in Tanakh, but you find it here in the Halal. And Rav Hirsch, in his commentary to Tehillim, comments on this. And he says something fascinating. See, there, min ha-meitza kara sika, anani v'merchav ka, ozi v'simras ka, it's really about the Jewish people struggling through history. They have difficult times and they have better times. Kogoyim sivavuni, their enemies. It's difficult, but they survive. So Rav Hirsch says that David HaMelech intentionally places here, within a description of the survival of the Jewish people against all odds, he brings in a pasuk from the miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf. And what he means to indicate through this is that when you consider the survival of the Jewish people with their difficulties and with their enemies and with everything that happens, you are witness to a miracle of the dimensions of Kriyas Yamsuf. Not to think that miracles happened in Parshas Beshalach and from then on nature takes over. That you need a miracle to keep the Jewish people going. They should have disappeared. And they're still there. Chai v'kayom. That's a miracle of the magnitude of Kriyas Yamsuf. And we're mindful again, we mention always the words of Rabbi Yaakov Emden in his introduction to his commentary on the Siddur. And he writes, and this is in the 1700s, and so much has happened since then, that when he just considers this, the continued survival of the Jewish people against all odds and every reason that they should just disappear, as far as he's concerned, Chai Roshi, by the life of my head, this eclipses any miracle that is described in the Chumash, not Kriyas Yamsuf and Eser Makos and all of the above. And you see that it has this resonance in the Psukim, where you have it's a Kriyas Yamsuf order of magnitude, as is invoked here, praising Hashem for the survival of the Jewish people. We should note that this pasuk, we said, it appears not only in Chumash but also in Tehillim, in Hallel. It also appears a third time with a slight modification, and that's in the Navi Yeshaya in Perek Yud Aleph. We say it every week in Havdalah. Those psukim are from Yeshaya, Perek Yud Aleph. Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, in his commentary to the Haggadah Shel Pesach, Minchas Oni, notes that this is the third and final time, actually, that this pasuk appears in Tanakh, but it's not exactly like the first two. For if we are medactic, the first two say, Aziv Zimras Ka, Vayihili Yeshua. This pasuk says, Ki aziv zimras ka Hashem, yudke vavke, vatihili lishua. You have the Shem Hashem in full on this setting, in Yeshaya Perek Yud Aleph. You don't have it not in Hallel and not in Kriyas Yamsuf. And Rav Ettlinger explains, and Rav Ettlinger was a Rebbe of Rav Hirsch, that, as we know from the end of this week's Parsha, Amalek come, there's a war, and they're defeated largely, but they score a certain success, and they make an impression. So much so, the final pasuk of this week's parsha, Hashem declares war on Amalek, because they've declared war on him and everything that he stands for. Godliness in this world. Ki yod al kes ka. A hand on the throne of Hashem. Milchama al Hashem ba'amalek midor dor. It's the laning for Purim morning, as we know. And we look at those words, ki yod al kes ka. Kes Ka is the throne of Hashem, but it's written chaser. Kes is missing the aleph. It's really kisei. Ka is yud and hey, but it's missing the vav and the hey. And Rashi comments from Chazal, because ein Hashem shalem, ein hakisei shalem, ad shimachar zar shel Amalek. Hashem's name nor his throne are complete until Amalek has been destroyed. Because as long as that anti-voice exists and persists in the world, and is looking to spread godlessness, So what's represented by Hashem's name and throne, recognition and appreciation of his rulership of the world, is compromised. In fact, I saw recently, it's a pasuk that we say, ki bachar Hashem b'tzion, iva l'moshav lo. It's in Psukei Dezimra, the selection of the psukim Yehi Kavod, ki bachar Hashem b'tzion, iva l'moshav lo. That's about the future. Hashem will choose Tzion, Eva, that's the place that he has chosen for Lemosha, though, to settle. Rabbi Shimshon of Astropoli says that when Hashem will settle, that's called Eva Lemosha, because Eva means to will, to desire something. Eva consists of the letters Aleph, Vav, and He. they are the missing letters from Kes Kah, the Aleph onto Kes to make Kiseh, and the Vav and the Hey to make the Shem Shalem. Ibal Amoshavla. So Rabbi Ettlinger says, that's why in the time of Kriyas Yamsuf, Amalek is still there. The time that David HaMelech is describing in Hallel, Amalek is still there. And therefore, Ki Aziva Zimras Ka, the name is Yud and Hey, but not Vav and Hey, the name is not Shalem. The time that the Navi Yeshaya is talking about, which is Hine Kelish Yosi Eftach Velo Efchad, Ki Aziva Zimras Ka, Hashem Vayhin Lishor. The Shem Hashem is mentioned in full because it's a reference to the time in the future when the Shem Hashem will be Shalem again. So that is the third and final installment of that pasuk there, so to speak. Okay. From here, let us conclude with take a look at Perek Tesvav, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. The first place that the Jewish people journey after Kriyas Yamsuf. Perek Tesvav, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. They've been through the Yamsuf, they've said as Yashir, Vayavo'u Marasa. And they come to Mara. V'lo yochlu lishtos mayim mimara, ki marim hei. They couldn't drink the water, ki marim hei. The water was too bitter. Alkein karashama, mara, and they complained, etc. Must mention a comment of the Baal Shem Tov. And in true Hasidic style, it's not the pshat in the pasuk, but it's a major truth in terms of life. The pasuk says they came to Mara. They couldn't drink the water. Lo yochlu lishtos mayim mimara ki marim hei, because they were bitter. Now the pasuk uses the plural heim because water is always in the plural mayim. So marim heim, they were bitter. Bitter water you can't drink. This is the Baal Shem Tov. He understands that the pasuk is saying that the word heim marim heim, they were bitter, is not qualifying the water. It's qualifying the Jewish people. They came to Mara. Couldn't drink water, they were bitter. The moral of the story is, says the Baal Shem Tov, is that very often the way that something tastes depends on you. Water is a neutral medium. It has no taste. But if you're bitter, then even water tastes bitter. So they were marim, so that they couldn't even drink the water. It's a lot of water situations that are colored by the disposition of the person himself. Okay, but back to Pshat. So they can't drink the water. The water is bitter. They complain to Moshe. Manishte. So kafei by Yitzhakel Hashem by Yirei Hashem Eitz. Moshe cries out to Hashem. Hashem showed him a certain tree. Vayashleich elamayim. He threw it into the water, and this tree itself was bitter. The whole thing doesn't make sense. Vayimtiku amayim, and the water became drinkable. Sham sam lochoku mishpat v'sham nisahu. These final words are rather cryptic. Sham sam lo. There he placed for him chok u'mishpat, statute and law, v'sham nisahu, and there he tested him. The question is, who placed for who? What's a chok and what's a mishpat? How is this the conclusion to what happened? Rashi comments, and it's sourced in the Gemara in Sanhedrin in the 7th Perek. Sham samlo b'mara nasal hem miktas parshia shel Torah. At that juncture, Hashem gave them certain sections of the Torah she is asku b'hem, to busy themselves with. Shabbos, para aduma, and dinim. Shabbos, para aduma, and mishpatim. Essentially, Rashi is taking the word chok u'mishpat, as we know, two types of mitzvahs. Chok u'mitzvahs, whose reason is beyond us. Mishpat, of course, is that we can understand. And therefore, for chok, Rashi gives two definitions, Shabbos and Paraduma. Paraduma, of course, is a chok. Shabbos seems less of a chok. We would normally group Shabbos with Eidos. Rashi here puts it as a chok, and Dinin, of course, laws are Mishpat. Now, that's Rashi's comment. Ramban has an interesting shaila, just with an eye on Pshat, and that is essentially that they're already receiving mitzvahs. Shabbos, Paraduma, Mishpat, they're already receiving mitzvahs. When you receive mitzvahs, says the Ramban, the appropriate expression is not to have them placed for you, they're commanded for you. One would have expected a pasuk like Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, Tzavis Bnei Israel, keep the Shabbos. So that's the standard presentation for a mitzvah. Here, Shamsamlo, it doesn't really sound like they're being given mitzvahs. But the Mizrahi, Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, explains Rashi's position that the reason why you don't have this introduction of Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor Tzavis B'nei Yisrael is because they weren't yet being given these mitzvahs as a command to perform them. They were being presented these sections to begin to learn them. And actually, Rashi's words are, Bemara nasa lahem miktas parsha shel Torah, they were given certain parshas, sheyis asku bahem, to busy themselves. But sheyis asku is more in the learning, like lasuk b'divrei Torah, not sheyikaimu osam or sheyasu osam. And the proof for this, in fact, says the Mizrahi, is that one of the mitzvahs they were given, according to Rashi, is Para Aduma. Now, there's no way that they could fulfill the mitzvah of Para Aduma at that stage, because the Para Aduma has to be slaughtered at a place called Pesach Ohel Moed, as the Pasuk says in Chukas. It's not valid if it's not shechted by the entrance of the Ohel Moed. When they're in Mora, they don't have an Ohel Moed. It's not yet practical, but already to begin to absorb and connect with these ideas. And therefore, she is asku behem, and that's why there is no tzavis bnei Yisrael. They're not being commanded to fulfill them yet, but rather to learn. And in fact, this understanding is corroborated and arrived at by another of the Rishonim, for actually a rather different reason, a very startling question. We received Shabbos at Mara. Now, the Or HaZeruah, one of the great Rishonim, Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna, has a shaila, a bit of a disturbing question. Without putting too fine a point on it, the Jewish people were not yet Jewish, because the full status of Yisrael came at Matan Torah, and they're a couple of weeks away. Now, of all the mitzvahs for a non-Jew to keep, Shabbos is the least advised. It's not permissible for someone who's not Jewish to keep Shabbos. And therefore, the Or HaZeruah asked Shaila, how can they be given Shabbos when they're in their pre-Jewish state? It's an interesting Shaila. As we know, someone who's in the process of converting, they have to make a point of not fully keeping Shabbos. They almost have to do a malach on purpose until the Geirus is complete. That's his question. And his answer is as per the above, that they're not yet being given the mitzvah of Shabbos to perform. They couldn't do that. They're ironically ineligible to perform the mitzvah of Shabbos yet. But to learn the halachos of Shabbos, she's asku behem, the Or HaZeruah understands, like Rashi, it's about the learning. And this issue will give us insight into something that we say in our tefillos. And it's always kedai to get further understanding in terms of these things that we say. In Musaf, so the middle section begins Tikanta Shabbos, it's the Aleph base backwards, Tafshin Reish Kuf, and it goes all the way back to Aleph, and Aleph says, Oz Misinai Nitztavu Aleha. Then, at Sinai, we were commanded about it. About what? About Shabbos. So Mefarshim asks a question. According to the Medrash, which is the source of Rashi's comment, one could say that we were actually commanded, it seems, before Sinai. And Sinai is when we got most of the Torah. But we were given some mitzvahs early. Mara is before Har Sinai. Why then do we say about Shabbos that we were given earlier than Sinai, Oz mi Sinai, Nitztavu Aleha? We're Nitztavu at Mara. That question is dealt with by Rishonim. And there are very interesting responses to this. The Kolbo of the Rishonim, he explains very interestingly that even though we'd received the mitzvah of Shabbos at Mara, however, there's an aspect of the Shabbos that we didn't receive at Mara, and that is Korban Musaf. And that much we didn't have. Shabbos was about keeping Shabbos, about not doing malacha, etc. and so forth. Zeichel Maaseh Bereishis. There's an aspect of Shabbos that's korbanos, and that's the aspect that we're talking about, obviously, within the context of Tfilas Musaf. We're only talking about Shabbos within the context of the Korban Musaf. And therefore, says the Kolbo, malachas of Shabbos, we may have been commanded about earlier than Sinai. But Musafim of Shabbos, which is the issue at hand here in Tfilas Musaf, Oz Misinai Nitztavu Aleha. That's the answer of the Kolbo. The Levush of the Acharonim has a rather novel way of looking at the words Oz Misinai. We translate the word Oz as then, which from a certain point of view could then be redundant, because Oz Misinai, then at Sinai, how is then being placed? The Levush suggests that the word Oz here might not mean then, but rather, as the Pasuk says, for example, Hashem Karani Reishis Darko, Kedem Mifalav Me'az, from then, meaning from before, from way back when. And he translates that Oz Misinai Nistav Olea doesn't mean then from Sinai. Oz Misinai means prior to Sinai, from before Sinai. In other words, a reference to Mara itself. That's the approach of the Levush. As a third approach, in light of our discussion, we may say very simply that if the question is, how can we say Oz Misinai Nitztavu Aleha, commanded about Shabbos Misinai, or we were commanded beforehand? Yes. But beforehand, it wasn't a commandment in the sense that it became obligated for us to keep Shabbos, but rather, Sam Lo Choku Mishpat. When was Shabbos presented to us? At Mara. When was Shabbos commanded to us? At Sinai. And therefore, there is actually no friction between the presentation of the laws to be involved with, which was earlier, but in terms of Halachas, Vatzaveinu, Oz Mit Nitztavu Aleha, that's Oz Mi Sinai. The only question that remains is, of all mitzvahs, if one may ask, I mean, it's a very short list of mitzvahs that we received at Mara, Shabbos, Paraduma, and Dinim. So leaving the others aside, we may ask, why is Shabbos chosen? Why is that apropos here at Mara? I mean, what's so special about Mara? We couldn't drink the water, then we could drink the water, and now here's Hilchos Shabbos. I mean, how does one relate to the other? So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says that, and it fits in very nicely actually with the fact that Shabbos is called a chok. We noted Shabbos doesn't seem to be a chok. I mean, Shabbos is eidos, right? It's well understood. It's not beyond us. But there is an aspect of Shabbos that's a chok, because chok means counterintuitive. You can't really explain it. We say that Shabbos is the mekor habracha. Likra Shabbos lechu v'necha ki mekor habracha. Keeping Shabbos brings bracha. That is to say, it brings material bracha. That's counterintuitive. Leaving aside the issue of taking a day off just to rest. But the notion that ceasing work will lead to an increase in bracha in one's parnasa, that pure formula alone is a chok. And the Jewish people need to absorb it, because Shabbos needs to stay with them. L'dorosam. And therefore, says Rabbi Yaakov, the optimum time to impart the lesson of Shabbos is when they just experience that at the end of the day, everything that they can receive materially is comes from Hashem. They couldn't even drink the water, but then HaKadosh Baruch Hu told, take this bitter wood, throw it in, and all of a sudden it's available for you. It doesn't really make any sense, but that's how Hashem runs the world. And at that juncture, it was the perfect time to talk about Shabbos, because Shabbos will be similar. Jewish people, once a week, on the seventh day, they'll close up. And someone will say, well, then how's your parnasa available? The same HaKadosh Baruch who made the water available in whatever way that he did, that's the time for the chok to be absorbed, and that was the optimum time to receive the lesson of Shabbos, which has been with us since then. Okay, we'll leave it over there for this evening.